listening to Truth To You Radio with Jono on truth2u.org. That's truth, number two, letter u.org, where you can sign up for our weekly newsletter, and you can also keep up to date via iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. And g'day, wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again. It is time for Light of the Prophets with Yoel Ben Shlomo. G'day, Yoel.
Good to you too.
Thank you for coming back, my friend. This is rather exciting. We're getting into, I guess, one of the most well-known judges of all time.
I think one of the well-known judges with one of the most interesting stories, mm-hmm. And with some of the most interesting, I would say, character developments from perspective of a person who also tries to study things more also on their narrative part of the idea. Mm. This is first of all one of the most famous stories. There have been several movies made about this story. It's so surprising. The entire Book of Judges, really, this is the only story that ever had movies made. There was a movie made back in the 50s. There's a movie made back in the 90s as well. Yeah. There's more to tell in these stories, again. Because we're not dealing with battles and fighting, whatever it is. There's a person here having his personal war against the Philistines. The character is completely different. This is also the last judge we actually have in the stories. Mm. I think that the character itself, also the story behind the characters, is a lot more complex, and it's also the only character that has supernatural powers.
Ah, that's a really good point.
And it's the only one.
And you're right. And if we are, of course, talking about Samson, and how do you pronounce that in Hebrew?
So it's called Shimshon. And Shimshon, it's a very interesting name. Let's start off with the name. Mm. First of all, you break down his name to two parts. It's Shemesh and On. Shemesh being sun, mm-hmm. sun with a U. It's not unusual for names to be sun something. There's many examples of different names. I can give you just off the top of my head. There was someone in the Ugaritic writings with it was Safsunu or something like that, and Dumu Sapsi, for strange names. There's also a man called Shimshi Bar Chelitz that's mentioned in the 5th century BC Aramaic letter. So combining Shemesh with something is very interesting. But there's a problem with this name, because Shemesh was also Shamsh, which was a pagan god. So there's also a kind of a struggle you see here with his name and what it represents. So, for example, what does the name might mean? So mm-hmm. the ending of On, there's two opinions regarding this On ending. We had Gideon as well, had the same idea. So remember I said Gideon might be the one who cuts off. Here I might say the one who shines like a sun. That's mm-hmm. might be one possibility. And it also might be because he was an only child to his mother and he came as a miracle.
Sure.
The other option is it's what's called a reducing suffix. We use it, for example, with the word ishon, which is the pupil of the eye. There were opinions, for example, Rabbi David Akimchi writes that ishon means small man, because if you look, sometimes it looks as if there's someone staring back at you through, if you look closely into the eye, someone's eye, to mm-hmm. think maybe it's like a little man, so here it's little son. But we're not 100% sure. But you can also see there's this struggle with mythology here, with part of his name and also his character, because there are other characters in the historical world that did very similar things, or not necessarily historical, but in the ancient world, there are other characters that did very similar things to Samson, and here we can see the fact that, first of all, they're not considering Samson being divine. There's no mythology. This is a live, kicking person who was a human being. But for example, just as an example, and I don't know if everyone will appreciate what I'm about to do here, but for example, we take Hercules, for example.
Mm-hmm. Hercules, the first one I think of is Hercules.
Hercules kills a lion. He used to walk, the story about Hercules, he walked around with a lion skin over his shoulders. Mm-hmm. He fell in love, and that caused his death. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, Samson is not a demigod. He's not anything like that. He's not an immortal or anything. He's a human being. And this is... something which is quite consistent with the Bible, that they're taking mythology and just rip-shredding it, saying, mm-hmm. forget about mythology. There's no mythology. There's no games. There's mm-hmm. God. He creates everything. He's mm-hmm. done everything. There is no mythology of the battle with the ocean. There's nothing. All these concepts that we find, for example, in the Book of Psalms, where he talks about places where some researchers wanted to say, oh, this is the mythology of the war of Baal against Moth and the ocean. So the Bible basically says, you know, there might be a memory, a historical memory in human beings' minds, but it's nothing really like that. It's really people looking, for example, you take the stories of Baal, that's from Ugarit, and Ugarit was next to the ocean. So every time they saw a storm, they thought, oh, it's Baal battling Moth. And here, really, the Bible is basically saying, what are you talking about? It's just a storm. But they're trying to shred out the whole mythology and the gods and everything. The same thing here. They're basically saying, oh, you want to really see why people are very, very strong sometimes? Okay, here's a case that we had in our world. And basically what they're saying is that God basically, once in a while, chooses a person to make them very, very strong so they have a certain purpose. And the fact that here Samson's birth is also I don't say preordained, but I would say that his birth is prophesied or told to his parents also shows the whole idea of him being sent by God for a purpose. That not mm-hmm. he's not powerful, or he's not, you know, what
he's,
he
he's
is
most by his own. Human.
Most he's most human. He's not powerful by his own right. He's powerful sure. because God gave him the power.
And so, as you said, he's number 12. Not only is he number 12, but he is the last judge mentioned in the Book of Judges, which is an interesting thing as well. But before we get to number 12, Yoel, there are three that we have to at least mention. They've got a couple of verses to their name. We better start from there. Kicking off from Judges chapter 12, verse 8, who have we got?
So there's Ivtzan from Bethlehem. So again, his name is very unusual. Some stories want to claim that it's Boaz from the Book of Ruth. I have difficulty understanding why it's that. Source of his name is also very unusual. But again, they mention again this 30 sons and the 30 daughters that he sent out, and he bought 30 women, 30 girls for his sons. Again, this whole issue of being very so they're basically saying God is kind of choosing people who are wealthy, which also means they're powerful in their communities, which means they're probably natural leaders. That's quite a possibility.
The interesting thing I found about that, Yoel, is that, of course, Yiptah, who we spoke about last week, he had one daughter, and the two judges on either side of him had 30 sons. And it's an interesting contrast, I thought. Of course, this chap doesn't have 30 sons who rode on 30 donkeys who rode on 30 donkeys, but this guy's got 30 sons and 30 daughters, and he's got 30. He brings in 30 daughters and so on and so forth. There's a lot of descendants, I suppose, which kind of, I wonder, I go back to Yiftach, and I wonder if, again, about the possibility of her being a perpetual servant of the Lord rather than being the subject of a sacrifice. I don't know, but again, there's certainly it seems to play him against the other judges on either side of him who have a lot of descendants anyhow.
So we mentioned that last week. We mentioned that the Yiftach is the saddest case we have.
Yeah.
Basically, it's a sorry excuse for a judge. And this is why he's contrasted from both ends. You have to remember, there's editing done. There's a message sent out here through the book. So
that's interesting.
It's not that simple. By the way, the reason I laughed was because he said 30 sons riding on 30 donkeys riding on 30 donkeys. Remember, we spoke about the idea that it's 30 sons with 30 donkeys, and the word is written as donkeys or ayarim, but it really means cities or towns. Mm. So just to clarify that. Then we have Elon Hazevuloni. So a man called Elon. Elon is more like the word Alon, which means an oak tree. So this man's called Oak. So his name actually makes sense. And he's from Zvulun, tribe of Zvulun. So he's from the north. And he only reigned for, he was a judge only for 10 years.
He was a judge for 10 years, but he's also, interestingly enough, he's also judge number 10. And he judged for 10 years.
And he's also buried in a place called Alon, the Ayalon. He's Elon who was buried in Ayalon. So again, this makes you wonder about what do the names really mean? Then we have a man called Avdon. So again, a man with on Avd is basically the word Avid, which means servant or slave. So the one who serves, so the one who is a slave, I think it probably means servant, the son of Hillel. Hillel is actually a common name until this very day in Hebrew. People might remember also from Hillel ben Shachar, which is usually translated as Lucifer, son of dawn. But Hillel, whether they're treated as Hillel ben Shachar, so it's a bit different, but from the same root. Hillel ben Shachar means the one whose prayer is at dawn, so it doesn't translate as Lucifer. There's no Lucifer there in the text, by the way. But he was named Hillel and was from a place called Pir'aton. And there's different opinions where Pir'aton is. I actually have a friend who pointed out to the village of Far'a in the mountains of Ephraim. So that's a possibility as well. But he again, he has 40 sons and 30 grandchildren, all riding on 70 donkeys. So again, this whole thing of 40 and 30, this makes you wonder wonder about all these numbers and everything. But there's an interesting thing here.
Before we go on, Yoel, there's a lot of emphasis on, there seems to be a prestige to riding on donkeys. What is the understanding of that?
So donkeys were the Volvo of the time.
Okay, fair enough.
No, seriously, because horses, let me explain something. Horses came from Egypt.
Yeah.
Okay? And first of all, there's a commandment about the king of Israel not to have too many horses so he doesn't go back to Egypt. Mm-hmm. So first you have to remember something. Horses were really, you know, that's the Rolls Royce. That's the, you know, the really expensive cars. Mm-hmm. And the next animal after it, specifically if you're living in a mountain range, horses are useless in mountain ranges. There's nothing you can do with them. This is why if you look around, donkeys. And I've ridden donkeys in mountain places. Poor donkey, I rode on his back and he's like, get off my back. essentially donkeys, first of all, a lot stronger.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have the issues that horses have. I mean, horses, again, they're a lot better. They're majestic animals, but they're useless in mountain areas. They're useless as carrying animals. Now, for example, if you want to put something on an animal's back, a horse is not strong enough for carrying the loads. I mean, you know, if you go back to, for example, the picture you put up for the Shabbat, remember a year ago or something we took a picture, people carrying wood and everything. So, for example, I've seen this with my own eyes. Donkeys being loaded with probably hundreds of pounds of firewood on their backs, and they just walk. You know, they just get through it, and you don't see anything. You don't see them suffering or anything. So donkeys and asses and all these, this entire family of animals, they're a lot better for mountain range. Remember, the Torah says, for the land I'm taking you to is a land of hills and mountains and valleys. Mm-hmm. So remember, a lot of these stories are actually happening near the mountain area. So this is why these animals are a lot more important in this region. You know, a 4x4 here in this area is a lot better than a regular car.
Sure, that makes sense. And so can I ask you another question? I know we're kind of getting off the topic here, but I know that the Tanakh also makes mention of mules. And at least in my English, I have references. I think I remember it talks about David's mule, and it's not an unusual word.
David had an aton.
Now, what's an aton?
Aton is the feminine of a donkey.
Really?
It goes like this. There's chamor, aton, and pered. Now, pered is a mixture of a horse and a donkey. Uh-huh. A chamor is a donkey, and a ton, if I remember correctly. I mean, again, I can actually, if you give me a second, I'll look it up in the dictionary just to make sure I haven't forgotten the word.
Please.
But if I remember, the aton is the feminine of the donkey.
Makes sense. So because I've always wondered, and the reason
a mule is a pered, so...
Uh-huh. You look it up there, I'm going to look it up here as well, because the reason why I ask...
Yeah, it's the feminine of the donkey. The reason you ask is because...
Okay, so a mule is a cross between a horse and a donkey.
Yes.
And I've got, in at least in the King James Version, mule occurs 7 times, and the word here, according to the Strong's, is pered.
Pered, yeah.
Pered.
So I think that King David, he might have had both, because I remember very clearly that he also had an aton as well. Okay. But it might be he had a pered. I mean, we can look at that in a second. Let's look also the word ayar, because I think the word ayar is a young donkey. Let me just make sure that I remember correctly. You know, there's a limit how much a brain can hold in it.
So what we have is we have Absalom has a mule. We have that in 2 Samuel 13 or so.
Yeah, 18. so An Ayar, so an Ayar is a young donkey. Mm-hmm. And Absalom, if I remember correctly, does have an Aton, and he rides it, and then he gets caught in the tree mm-hmm. there. But let's look at King David for a second, because there's one place where it clearly states what animal he had, and that's when they crowned King Solomon.
Yes. Yeah, that's right.
That's where it clarifies. He says, tells him, take my certain animal, which I've been riding. It should be in 1 Kings. Pirda. So he has a female mule.
Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. He has a female mule. So there's the Torah that tells us not to cross two different kinds of seed in the field, and not to you know, there's these kind of things.
Yes.
Yet here we see the crossing of a mule, of a horse and a donkey.
So, but who says that? Who says that he did? The prohibition in the Torah is to actually do it. But if it's already done, what's the prohibition of using it?
Interesting.
It raises a lot of questions, I agree. It raises questions about a lot of other subjects as well. If someone else does something, for example, Jews, for example, don't hold that a Gentile has to keep Torah. You know, we believe that the covenant of Torah was only given to the children of Israel, though it's an open club. You know, you can walk in whenever you want. Mm. Club, quote unquote. I'm just using it as a joke. But for example, anyone's welcome to join. But if the person is not joined, then they're not committed. They don't have to commit to Torah. Now, there's, for example, an opinion that says, you know, I completely disagree with this opinion. Maimonides also disagrees with the opinion. But basically, the opinion that says, a very strong opinion, it's practiced in the Jewish world, is that if you have someone who's not Jewish, you can have them work for you during Shabbat. And I don't understand how exactly that works. Yes, exactly. Sabbath boy. We spoke about this when we spoke about Shabbat.
Hmm.
And I don't use it. I've never used a Sabbath boy. I hold by the opinion of the Maimonides. It's also the opinion of the Elfasi. So it's not a opinion that flies with me. But there is such a thing. So, for example, if someone else does it, is there a problem? But here specifically, if you look at, you know, this kind of gives us kind of sometimes an understanding of things that are actually literal. It says, don't mix these animals. But if it's already happened, a donkey broke out of somewhere and he pregnant a horse, or the other way around. It already was born.
And okay. There it is.
Is there a prohibition to use it? I don't see any prohibition at all. I don't see any verse that says you're not supposed to use them. That says don't crossbreed them. But it raises a question, you know, if the sun is thinking also into the direction of, if something is forbidden to do, would it make sense to also, if any, the outcome is also forbidden? And there is an approach like that sometimes. So again, the questions, and there's another question we can raise through Samson as well, that we probably won't touch on today, but next week. But we eventually we see King David using a mule, and there's no sign of prohibition there. So
yeah.
The understanding is that if someone in the Bible did something and we don't see any criticism about it, or we don't have a clear verse in the Torah that says forbidden, then we can't turn around and say they did something which is forbidden, which probably teaches us that this is allowed. Well, we're not allowed to do crossbreeding. So you raise the question, for example, what do you do with crossbred fruits?
Yeah, that's the next question that it leads to, most certainly.
So I saw a discussion a while back on Facebook by friends of mine. I didn't get involved. But there was a discussion there, and I think there was a man there, I can't remember his name at the moment, who gave a very, very clear answer about this. And he said that essentially, first of all, the prohibition is on us from doing it. And if it's already done, then there's no prohibition on us. And also, there's a question of exactly how do you exactly do the crossbreeding. And you should know that pollinization, for example, causes crossbreeding as well.
Cross-pollinization.
So there's a lot of questions that have to be asked about these things. But I think his answer like really hit the nail over the head. I don't remember exactly all the details, but everything he wrote that I agreed with. And the idea is that, you know, if someone else does it, it's not sure. Also, the issue of crossbreeding, what the Torah forbids of crossbreeding is not really crossbreeding. It actually talks about not mixing seeds together in the same field. But if I take, for example, an orange and a citrus fruit, and we put them together, and we produce a new fruit, I don't think there's a problem with that. Also, there's a question: how do you exactly define crossbreeding? Because, for example, there are fruits that there's things you can't crossbreed. It doesn't happen. Mm. There are types of animals you can't, for example, crossbreed a goat with an ox or something, or a dog or anything. It doesn't happen. If I remember correctly, also with fruits, it's the same thing. You can't crossbreed anything. You can only crossbreed things inside the same family. I need to ask someone I know that there's someone I know who's an expert in crossbreeding. I need to ask them about that. But if I remember correctly, what they told me was that you can't crossbreed things which are not from the same family. And the moment they're from the same family, it's not really crossbreeding.
Mm. So it's a fascinating discussion. And so sorry to lead us off down the garden path there, but I just had to ask you because it popped into my mind recently when I was reading and I saw the word mule. And of course, as soon as you realize what a mule is and it gets you thinking, and then you think there's a lot of, you know, obviously they weren't without donkeys, not without horses. So very interesting. In any case, this is the 11th. He is the 11th judge and Avdon. And he died and he was buried. Where was he buried?
So he was buried in Piraton, in the mountain of the Amalekites, which raises the question, what on earth are these Amalekites doing in the mountains of Ephraim? And it could be that it was named the Mountain of Amalekites because it was a time when the Amalekites were there, or it could be that there was a time the Amalekites controlled the area after he was buried. Have to remember, this was written after the accounts. So it can be the mountains of Ephraim, a place they called the Mountain of the Amalekites. It could have been an Amalekite settlement there at one stage, and they got rid of him.
Yeah, so there's a period of time there where three of them, again, as far as we know, seemingly, you know, peaceful time, not too much to tell. But here we are in chapter 13, and it says, again, the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord delivered them into the hand of the Philistine for 40 years. And now there was a certain man from Zorah.
Just a second. Just remember something very simple. Last week we mentioned this as well, that here it's mentioned in one verse. Last week we had this entire section where it talks about all the different gods that they were worshipping, etc. And I mentioned the fact that the Ammonites and the Philistines are mentioned there as an opening for here. So this is the reason why it's one verse here instead of like an entire introduction. Because we just had an entire introduction with Yiftach.
Sure. No, excellent point. Now, there was a certain man from Zorah of the family of the Danites whose name was Manoah, and his wife was barren and had no children. Manoah. Then what does Manoah mean?
Manoah. So Manoah is very similar to the name Noah. So Manoah is a person who can mean the person who has, quite peace and quiet. You know? So Manoah is from the root of Noah to be. It can also be from the word Menachem. With another variation of the name Menachem, the one who comforts.
Okay,
and so this is probably a real name.
And the angel of the Lord appeared to the woman and said to her, "Now enter the angel of the Lord, the messenger of the Lord appeared to the woman and said to her, indeed, now you are barren and have borne no children, but you shall conceive and bear a son."
So, by the way, we have to ask ourselves a very simple question: this stranger walks up to her. He looks like a man. Okay, let's clarify something very, very important. Angels appeared up to a certain stage. Angels appeared as people. Mm-hmm. Now there has been, and it's a very strong thing in the Catholic world that every time you have this type of case, it's really God appearing before these people. And this is a misinterpretation because the word ish, again, we have, so it mentions. An angel of the Lord appeared before the woman, but there's another place where she tells her husband
very clearly.
Where is it?
That a man, in fact,
Ish,
on a number
Ish
of occasions. Yeah, on a number
it says,
of occasions.
It says Ish Elohim.
Yeah.
Man of God. So she's basically saying it was a human being. He was a prophet. Hmm. But because of the fact, why does Ish call him Ish Elohim? How does she understand he's an Ish Elohim? She says, and is the way he looks is like the angel of God. So it's kind of strange. Is he a man? Is he something else?
It is because she says he appears like that, and yet she acknowledges him as a man. And I believe we're going to see that her husband also does. So let's keep checking on that because I had to underline all the different times that this messenger was referred to either as the messenger of the Lord or a man of God or the angel of God or so on and so forth. So it seems to go back and forth.
Yeah, so there's an issue here. Again, this is not the first time we have the book of Judges. A man appears before someone. Mm-hmm. And in this case, she perceives that there's something unusual about him. Her mm-hmm. husband is completely, he's skeptic, like it's no one's business. He doesn't believe
and anything. She's excited. She's really excited about it.
She's excited about it, and she's like, you know, oh, this man appeared in front of me, and he was a man of God, and he looked like a... Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that he was glowing or something, but the mere fact that a man walks up to her and tells her something, she doesn't recognize him, she doesn't know who he is, he looks like a foreigner, and he walks in, foreigner, I mean, he's not local, mm-hmm. and he walks up to her and says, you're a barren woman, and you're going to give birth very soon. Then immediately strikes a person as a man of God, and immediately puts like a halo around the person, even if it's in the eyes of the beholder, mm-hmm. but in her mind, this man had a halo around him. So it doesn't necessarily mean that she actually saw something, you know, that he walked up with a pair of wings or whatever.
But he stands out, right? He's special. He's given her a message that she recognizes as, at least he's spoken as someone who has the authority of God, and she's really excited about it. So I'm going to use the word messenger. Let's use messenger instead of angel for a while and see what happens.
Yeah, messenger is always better because angel is from the Greek world and it has a slightly different meaning.
And the imagery that we have of angel is generally from the Greek world as well. In fact, in fact, a Greek goddess.
Not necessarily correct because the way what we look as angels, that's actually from the Persian, Babylonian Persian world. The winged beings and everything, it's way before the Greeks. The Greeks, what's interesting about the Greeks is that they had a word that sounds like angel. It obviously developed into Latin and it was before that Greek and everything. But the idea of appearances of angels in the Greek mindset was the appearing of a god. Because the Greeks didn't have angels. There were no angels. That the gods needed to do something, they either had their messengers, but were not angels the way we perceive them. So there's this concept in the Greek world. I think one of the classic places to see that, the opposing ideas, is what's called divine revelation or divine appearance. And I think in the stories of Troy, if you take the original stories of Troy and you read them, there's this whole thing that if, for example, a god intervenes in the help of a person, helping one of the characters, for example, I think Hector gets help there, I think, one of the characters there. There's like a halo around him, if I remember correctly, and that gives him the ability to fight. So that's really I'm only speculating because I'm not an expert in Greek mythology and stuff like that, but if I remember correctly reading it in one of the books I have, they mention that this is not an angelic appearing, this is a divine appearance, but it's represented in a certain way, and its meaning is completely different. So really the Greeks didn't have angels, it was the Catholic Church that took the concept of angels from the Bible with the whole imagery of winged beings, and there's a whole discussion we can have about that, and incorporated the Greek style of image, drawing them in a certain way.
That's what I'm referring to. So it's so you're quite right. I mean, the concept itself comes from Persia, but the way that we perceive them today, traditionally, particularly in the Christian background, comes from the Roman copies of Greek marble statues of their gods, and there was a particular Greek goddess who was winged, and it might have been Eos
I
don't remember anymore.
It might have been.
Yeah. But that imagery is certainly, it's very easy to see that connection.
But what I find interesting here later on in the chapter, we also had this with Gideon, is that they still consider an angel appearing as a divine revelation to a point where they think, oh, we're going to see an angel and we're going to die.
Yeah, no, he does say that. So let me read it because it says, the messenger of the Lord appeared to the messenger of Yehovah appeared to the woman and said to her, indeed, now you are barren, you have no children, but you shall conceive and bear a son. Now, therefore, and here are the instructions, please be careful not to drink wine or similar drink, not to eat anything unclean. Now, when I've got here unclean, Yoel, is that he's saying, hey, don't eat a pig or anything like that? Or is it defiled food or what word do you have there?
So first of all, hishamri na, the word na doesn't really have to be translated as please. It can be translated as emphatic. You will do this.
Uh-huh.
Okay, but by the way, the word na, yes, there is a word translating as please, but there is also where translated as emphatic, and it depends sometimes. I mean, if you really want to go into that, we can do that, but we're not going to do it. But just bear in mind that there's a possibility that he's telling her what to do and not asking her what to do. Now, as she says here, she says, don't drink wine and any alcoholic drinks. By the way, the word shechal used here again, remember, yain v'shechal. This is almost a quote from the Book of Numbers, okay, because he's going to be a Nazirite. But right. his entire Nazirite thing is very, very peculiar. We can talk what about the Nazirite in a moment. So it says, yain v'shechal, v'tishtein v'shechal v'atochi kol tameh. So what does it mean, tameh? Tameh, again, unclean, can also be that, for example, it doesn't necessarily mean that she goes eat pig. Obviously, I think that he's talking about something completely different. Mm. He might be talking about foods that were contaminated. For example, if you remember, you look back into the Book of Leviticus, it mentions that, for example, types of food, grain, for example, if it gets wet and then touched or gets something on it that makes it unclean, it becomes unclean. He might be telling her you have to be very, very careful from making yourself unclean at any stage, even from simple things. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that she becomes unclean. It's just the food itself is unclean. So, for example, we go back to, for example, the Book of Haggai, and it mentions, for example, if someone carries a piece of meat in the wing on the skirt of his clothing and it touches this and that, does it do anything? So there, he's specifically talking the other way around, that something becomes holy by touching it. Mm-hmm. Here he's basically saying if someone contaminated this piece of food, and I don't think it makes the person unclean, but what I think he's basically trying to say is don't eat contaminated food. Mm. Well, I went a very long distance with that one, I consider it in two words. Anyhow.
No, I agree. That's why I asked. So it goes on to say, for behold, you shall conceive and bear a son, and no razor shall come upon his head, for the child shall be a Nazirite to God from the womb, and he shall begin to deliver Israel out of the hand of the Philistines. Now, this is By the way,
he says begins and not he will deliver, because he doesn't really finish off the Philistines until King David. David is really the one who crushes the Philistines.
Mm. So he begins to do that. But it says, Yoel, here, it's not, I mean, the Nazirite vow is a voluntary vow, right? Not so here. Yeah. He says to her, he will be a Nazirite from the womb, not even from the moment that he's born, but you will not, you won't be drinking, you have nothing from the vine and so on and so forth. It starts now.
So by the way, do you know who the other character is done to?
Who else is it done to?
Samuel, Shmuel.
I didn't know that. He's a Nazirite from the womb?
If I remember correctly, let's go to the Book of Samuel for a second. I think when she asks for the child, she takes a vow. It's not really it's very interesting. He says here, it's in 1 Samuel, 1st chapter, verse 11, she says, and she takes an oath, and she says here, that he will be holy to God all his days of life. And a morah, which usually is used the same way in the Numbers, morah lo yale al rosho, that his head will never be shaven. So that's another way of taking an oath. So actually, there's a Mishnah that says that if a person says that he will never shave his head ever again, or he will not shave his head for 30 years, whatever it is, it's actually taking a Nazirite oath. So if we go back to the book of Numbers, very, very quickly, because let's look at the language there. And I've taken over the bus here, but then...
No, that's anyhow. Okay, that's okay. Because no, I'm just reading it here. Let me read verse 11 just before you do that. So she made a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your maidservant and remember me and not forget your maidservant, but will give your maidservant a male child, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall come upon his head. How about that?
So I'm looking for the place, because I remember, maybe I'm wrong about the words themselves, but morah is a razor, and there should be a place which is morah. No, maybe it's really from here, morah le'al rosho, but it's basically saying, it's probably that, but it's basically saying his hair, he won't shave his head ever. So some people recognize that as him being a Nazirite.
That's really interesting.
I want to look into something very, very quickly, because I think there's another place where it uses the word morah as raising, because morah can also be could be a fear, but it doesn't make sense. Morah from the root of yara, which is very similar to the root of Torah, but it's a completely different word. I think when Samson speaks with Delilah, he says to her the same thing. He says, "Vayomer lah morah lo ala al roshi, a razor's never gone on my head." So it's the same language. It's exactly the same language. Samson uses the exact same language.
So Samuel was a Nazirite. So, I better read these verses.
It seems so.
Should I read these verses from Numbers?
I think we have to do that.
So then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel. This is Numbers chapter 6, children of Israel, and say to them, when either a man or a woman consecrates an offering to take the vow of a Nazarite to separate himself to the Lord, he shall separate himself from wine and similar drink. He shall drink neither vinegar.
Yours says similar drink. The Hebrew says shechar. In Akkadian, shechar, if I remember correctly, means beer. So there were basically two alcoholic drinks in the ancient world. There was wine and there was beer. The Egyptians had beer, and the Babylonians, the Akkadians had beer. Mm-hmm. And beer has been around for a while.
The Egyptians invented beer, but I mean, does that mean that he can hammer on with vodka, or I mean, what?
So the understanding is basically any alcoholic drink. Shechar, because not using the word beer or anything like that, or what it's really the word beer, though maybe the Akkadian does really actually means beer. But what we understand here is that any alcoholic drink, so wine and beer were the two ones, and then in time, you know, people created other drinks as well.
Mm-hmm. And so that includes vinegar made from wine.
Mm-hmm. It's vinegar made from any alcohol. So it's chometz yain, chometz shechar. Mm-hmm. So chometz yain is wine vinegar. And chometz shechar is alcohol, vinegar produced from any other type of alcohol. So you raise the question, for example, if we can produce a type of vinegar that's not from an alcoholic beverage.
Sure.
I mean, I'm not too sure exactly. For example, synthetic vinegar. What is the role of synthetic vinegar? So I've known about three people who have taken the Nazarite oath.
Truly?
I know several people have done this. Mm-hmm. One of them was a friend from yeshiva. The other one was a friend from the army. And then there's a third friend. And two of them continued. One of them, the one from yeshiva, in the end got an annulment for his vow. Which is kind of interesting. Yeah, I remember asking him about that. And he said that in the end, remember we spoke about vows last week as well?
Yeah.
So I kind of raised a brow about that. But apparently a rabbi said because of a certain circumstances, he allowed him to annul the vow. I don't really understand how that was done, but, because the rule is with Nazarites is if you take a Nazarite oath, that's it.
That's it.
You're stuck.
Yeah. That's serious stuff. And so, not only wine and alcoholic beverage. So it's also just grape juice or anything from the grapes, even the raisins, the sultanas, all the days of your separation, you shall eat nothing that is produced by the grapevine from seed to skin.
By the way, what about the leaves?
Well, Oh, they're beautiful.
Yeah, you've had those before. So they're very, very nice as well. And they're very common here in Israel. I mean, I can take you to the shuk and show you places where they sell them fresh. You just buy them and you make them.
We'll be doing that.
Mm-hmm. stuff them with lamb meat and rice.
Rice and, you're making me hungry. All right, stop. But all the days of the vow of your separation, no razor shall come upon his head until the days are fulfilled, which he separated himself to Yehovah. He shall be holy. Then he shall let the locks of his hair of his head grow, and all the days that he separates himself to Yehovah, he shall not go near a dead body, and he shall not make himself unclean, even for his father or his mother, his brother and his sister, when they die, because his separation to God is on his head. All the days of his separation, he shall be holy to Yehovah. So you can't go to their funeral.
There's a lot of questions here about this, about Samson. He drinks wine, he kills, you know, he walks around in the vineyard. The walking around the vineyard, there's a rabbinic law that they said that a Nazarite's not supposed to even get near a vineyard. Mm-hmm. Not even allowed to touch the leaves. But here with Samson, we see he walked in. But with Samson, the entire thing is just all strange. The main thing with Samson is hair. The rest of it, he just
yeah, that's true. Because he didn't say to everything Delilah, else. We're going to read about that, but it's not as if he said to Delilah, you know, if I drink, if I eat a grape, then my strength will go from me. No, it's about the hair. It's really interesting.
It's all about the hair, and the whole thing is very. It's very strange, the whole thing in the Nazarite of Samson. Because first of all, a person can take an oath of Nazarite to be a Nazarite his entire life. That's true. But he still has to go according to these laws. Also, what is the purpose of becoming a Nazarite? It's a big question.
I
think it's an issue of being sanctified to God as well, choosing to be sanctified, but there are restrictions on the person. And I remember one of my friends asked me, you know, what is the purpose of, you know, what is the purpose of being a Nazirite? Why did I take this oath? And I really stood there in front of him and said, I really don't know. But throughout the time, I've been thinking about this, and I think the answer is that this person becomes holy to God. He becomes marked out, which means this person is probably, you know, he'll become a leader, or he can be in the service of the temple, or he becomes an authority on things because he becomes sanctified to God. And there's different things, but the whole idea of being sanctified to God is the same thing with the Levites and the priests. So it could be that Nazirites were allowed to have service in the temple, or they had an important position as holy men. Mm-hmm. I have to remember again, we don't really have this concept today in the Jewish world, but I think in the ancient world they actually had holy men who were considered to be closer to God by making mm-hmm. these decisions. Obviously, you know, like priests, I mean, these people could get married and everything.
Sure.
But for example, the word Nazir in Hebrew today is also from the same word used for monks, but it's not the same idea. But there's a lot of questions here we have to ask about Samson's Nazirite. It's not even an oath; it's been forced on him, which raises a lot of questions as well.
As well, yeah.
And by the way, it says here Gadel Pera Sarosho. Pera doesn't mean just to grow long; it's to grow wild.
Oh, so wow!
They have wild hair. This is how they were marked, because people in the ancient world had longish hair or even long hair.
So we do understand that he had the Bob Marley going on, or what?
He had dreadlocks grow at one point because the hairs tangle. So what it looks like, I mean, I was looking at images of people from this region of, you know, Mesopotamia, land of Israel, Canaanites, and men did have long hair, but they kept it tidy. Here it's saying, you know, he's growing his hair long. He's not just growing it long; he's growing it wild. So he's having almost a Bob Marley type of thing going on with him. So yeah. It's not just growing long hair, it's growing the hair wild.
So there it is. And so it continues in Numbers chapter 6 to verse 21. We won't read it all, but listeners would pay to go and do a little bit of homework there. But it goes on to say, so the woman came and told her husband, a man of God, came to me, his countenance was like the countenance of a messenger of God. What is the word for countenance? Is it face?
It says here, I've lost my place just a second because I was going back.
Sorry, verse 6. Verse 6.
Just a second. No, I was in the wrong chapter. I was like, where am I? It says the word mar'ehu from the word mar'eh, which is his imagery, the way he looked. Okay. Not necessarily his face, though recognizing a person mostly through the face. But mar'ehu means his aura, I don't know how you call it, his the general way he looked.
Okay, because she goes on to say in English, what I've got, the countenance of a messenger of God, very awesome. Is that what you put?
Very awesome. That's so nora me'od, the word nora is from the root of yara, which is with nalef, which means to fear. So it struck some kind of, like, not necessarily fear, but, you know, a feeling of greatness.
Reverence.
Reverence, exactly. You see this person and there's this glow about him, and it doesn't certainly mean there was actually something physical. It might be, but I doubt it. Here it's really, she's just saying this, the person walks up and there's this presence about this person, there's this feeling about them, there's this projection of the way they look, the way
they
behave.
That's what I think. Yeah. I think you're right about that. I don't think it has so much to do with their physical appearance, but the way that they present themselves commandingly, perhaps, and with authority, and that she recognizes this man is from God. He's a messenger from God. He's awesome. But she said, but I did not ask where he was from, and he didn't tell me his name. And he said to me, behold, you shall conceive and bear a son. Now drink no wine or similar drink nor anything, eat anything unclean, for the child shall be a Nazirite to God from the womb to the day of his death. Then Manoah prayed to Yehovah and said, oh, my Lord. Now, is that Adonai?
It's written as Adonai, and not only like that, it's written with a vav, which is very unusual.
How about that? Why would it be written with a vav? We don't know.
You can go into the whole discussion of the way they spell things. I mean, again, we have to remember the existence of a vav or yud, the lacking of a vav or yud, or with a certain type written like this. This all has to do with spelling traditions of how they did things. For example, if you take the Dead Sea Scrolls, Dead Sea Scrolls uses more vowel point consonants. They have a name in Latin, but we'll forget about that one. It's called Imot Kriya, mothers of speech or mothers of reading, where they basically give you vowel points. So in Dead Sea Scrolls, for example, we have more. If we go to the First Temple period, we have less use of these, and they're actually trying to write everything in the shortest form possible. Mm-hmm. So really, there are places where we see sometimes what's more characteristic of Second Temple spelling, and then places where we have more First Temple spelling. Mm-hmm. And it's a transmission of traditions, and the Masoretes just were trying to make sense out of the different traditions they had in front of them. One of the things, for example, I noticed is that in the Book of Psalms, there's a lot of Dead Sea Scroll style coming out there. The places where I noticed when I'm working with students, and we, for example, try to work with something for the Book of Psalms, and I've noticed this more and more, because when you read it by yourself, you're just reading, you don't notice everything. But when you sing with a student, you pay attention to more details, and you notice this. So it's very, very interesting. I would say one very simple thing, because I heard this attack that was on the Masoretes, and I did publish something on Facebook about this, and I will say something very, very simple. The fact that there's a vav or yud or an aleph or a hey, a small variation, is it doesn't mean that someone changed the text.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this idea has to be stopped.
Mm.
Okay, because we know one thing as a fact: the people from the Dead Sea Scrolls, there are scrolls that we know as a fact were deliberately changed to fit theological ideas. Mm-hmm. And for example, there are places, just as an example, Psalm 145, they added a verse there because they wanted to be in alphabetical order, but we know as a fact this was added in, and there are markers in that added verse that show that it's not from the original.
Mm-hmm.
So if anyone hears this idea of, the Masoretes changed something because there's a vav or yud or something like that, it's way deeper than that. They didn't change anything. It's a lot more complex than just saying they changed.
Okay, and so here's an example with Adonai with a vav, and he prays, please let, and he describes it as the man of God, whom you sent to come to us again and teach us what, now this is weird, Yoel, teach us what we shall do for the child who will be born. But of course, the messenger already told his wife, and his wife has already told Manoah, but now Manoah is saying, send him again so he can tell me. And then God listened to the voice of Manoah, and the messenger of God, came to the woman again as she was sitting in the field, but Manoah, her husband, was not with her. Then the woman ran in haste and told her husband and said, look, the man who came to me the other day has just now appeared to me. So Manoah arose.
Just a second. You're running through and you're letting me talk. There's something very important here. There's actually a rabbinic tradition that says that Manoah was a skeptic and was an idiot. They actually bluntly call him an idiot in the Talmud.
He seems to be, there's a couple of reasons why they might say that, and we're going to get to them, but there's a few things where you kind of think, you don't seem to be getting it. Why? You seem to be confused.
So there's a whole thing. They also say his wife was greater than him. They say that her level of belief was greater, therefore she was greater than him, and this is where the revelation came to her every time.
Sure.
You also see this skepticism. He kind of trusts his wife, but not really. So he's like, I want to hear it too. He's like one of these, this man who walks up. I'm the one. Yeah, I'm the man here. I'm the one who knows.
And, because he says to God, send the man so that I can get the details. But the man comes again. The messenger comes to the woman, and the woman runs. The wife runs and tells the husband.
I think part of it also is the fact that the commandments are directly related to her, because she's the one who has to make sure she doesn't do certain things. So she's the one who's going to bury him. She's the one who has to make sure she doesn't eat unclean and doesn't drink wine, etc. And she's the one who's going to raise him, because children were with the mother until like the age of 5 or 6. So a lot of the education came from the mother. So this is why he's appearing to her. Her husband is like, you're irrelevant. But there's also an issue here that he is probably a bit of a skeptic. He doesn't really believe that strongly about certain things. And he's skeptic throughout the entire thing. He's like, maybe you're this, maybe you're that. And we see this in his behavior.
So he arose and he followed his wife, and he came to the man and he said to him, are you the man? I'm sorry, I have to laugh. Because I'm just thinking of what you said in the rabbinic opinion of this guy. He gets up, he follows his wife. His wife has already said, the guy's appeared to me, the man has appeared to me. He said, take me to the man. He follows his wife to the man, and when he gets there, he says, are you the man? Are you the man who spoke to this woman?
There is a certain degree of that. Yes, I agree.
There is a bit. And the man said, I am. And Manoah said, now let your words come to pass. What will be the boy's rule of life and his work? And so the messenger of the Lord, the messenger of Yehovah, said to Manoah, I've already told her. That's pretty much what he says.
He's like, I told her. Why do you need me to say this one again?
Yeah, he says.
So he's very, he's very skeptic. He's like, oh, the woman's like, you know, she really wants children. She's imagining stuff. She's developing hope. And it's like, when you take, first you have to remember something. Samson is the, as I mentioned, is the only character that has supernatural powers. Mm-hmm. So there's also a contrast here that believing and accepting God, the God of Israel as your God, and accepting what he tells you to do will give you the power to overcome many things. And one of the cases we have here is also his mother being barren. And, you know, he's basically turning around and saying, believe. And Samson's father, Manoah, is like, well, he doesn't believe. So he doesn't receive the revelation. He doesn't come up to him. And there's a whole thing here. And also Samson, you have to remember, you know, there's also a conflict with Samson. He's very, very strong. But he, at one point, he starts believing the strength comes from him. And in the end, he has to accept the fact that the strength does not come from him. It comes from somewhere else. And I think this is one of the messages trying to be being pushed here inside this section, where you know, sometimes this trust in God, just accept the fact that he's telling you something and don't start asking too many questions. I think this is, you know, they're using the characters of his father and mother as a contrast of probably an internal conflict that Samson had, which might be part of the development of what's been going on with him as a person later on, because he sees his mother as a very believing person. You know, his mother, you know, tells the story of, you know, the man came to me and everything, and she's all very, like, you know, it happened and everything. And his father's like, whatever. And that probably also is a part of the development of his character, because he's in a conflict inside of himself throughout the entire story.
Sure.
So there's a psychological background here, basically.
So he says, you know, of all that I said to the woman, let her be careful that she may not eat anything that comes from the vine, or nor may she drink wine or a similar drink, or anything, eat anything unclean. All that I commanded her, let her observe. Then Manoah said to the angel of Jehovah, please let us detain you, and we will prepare a young goat for you. Yum.
He's testing him. He's not sure yet. He's testing him.
Yeah, so the messenger of Jehovah said to Manoah, though you detain me, I will not eat your food, but if you offer a burnt offering, you must offer it to Jehovah. For Manoah did not know he was the messenger of Jehovah.
Well, first of all, it's not in brackets in the Hebrew text.
Mm-hmm.
But it's as if it's in brackets, basically. The text itself is written away where it actually is. So, no, side note, by the way, he did not know that he was an angel. She sees it, he doesn't.
He doesn't.
She immediately identifies him as a messenger of God, and he's like, oh, whatever, you know.
So verse 17, Manoah said to the messenger of Jehovah, what is your name? Now, oh my goodness, Yoel, what is your name that when your words come to pass, we may honor you? What does the messenger say?
So first of all, what is his question? What is your name? What do you care what my name is? What does it matter what my name is? And he says to him, why do you need my name? Why do you care about my name?
Hmm.
You know, what's the point of knowing my name? And question mark. And then there's a question, is the two last words here in Hebrew is an answer? He actually answered him, or the writer is telling us. But to be very clear about something, that when your words come and we were able to respect, it's like, you know, it's like saying, you know what, I want to know your name, that when it actually happens, I'll be able to know it's true, and I'll be able to figure out where you are and tell everyone the story. He's completely skeptic. He's just looking at this whole thing and saying, well, this guy's smoking something, my wife is smoking something, everyone's completely loony here. You know something, this kind of reminds me of discussions I've had with people that, you know, they're very skeptic about everything, but they don't want to insult you, so they'll ask certain questions to get the hint. They don't really believe you, and I think there's also, you know, some level here of, like, you know, these were the first you know, the kind of questions like of atheists, but they're trying to be respectful, so they're asking certain leading questions. Now, so I understand that this verse is basically saying, I want to know what your name is, so when this actually happens, or if it doesn't happen, I'll also be able to find you.
Mm-hmm.
It might be. I'm not saying this is 100%. He might be actually believing. He might say, you know, I believe you, and when it happens, I want to tell everyone that this you're the person who came over to say it. Now, the question of his name, what is the point of knowing his name? You know, besides that, you know, what is names of angels? What is the deal with that? What is this whole thing of giving angels names?
If Manoah is looking at him and saying, hey, maybe you're a prophet and here you are giving a prophecy that she's going to give birth and he's going to be like this, and he's going to begin to deliver the children of Israel out of the hand of the Philistines and so on and so far, so forth. Maybe he's saying, if you're a prophet, let us have your name so that when your prophecy comes true, we can say, you know, such a prophet, blah, blah, blah. But I don't know. I mean, it's like let us prepare you a meal, and the messenger says, I will not eat your food, but if you offer a sacrifice, you must offer it to Yehovah. Don't offer it to me. Don't present me with a gift. You need to offer your sacrifice to Yehovah. And if the next verse is in the same vein, then it would make sense that he would be saying, why are you asking my name? Because what I've got here in the English is, why are you asking my name, seeing it is wonderful? Question mark.
So I don't know if it's a question, because it says Vehu Feli. Oh, actually, it's really Feli. The Aleph is completely silent, but the root is Pele. So this is part of the issue with the Aleph. There's a theory that says that the Aleph was always vocalized. For those students, people who actually have studied Hebrew, there are several consonants in Hebrew that go silent. One of them is Aleph. Aleph really represents a vowel point and not really a consonant.
Mm-hmm.
This is why in some places they teach that the Aleph is a non-existing, a non-vocalized consonant. But because there's a theory that says that the Aleph was vocalized, and the theory was developed based on other texts from other languages where these were considered to be phonetic languages, that everything was vocalized, and we see Aleph showing up all over the place. So they theorize that the Aleph was vocalized. And this is why it was able to survive in the root, because we have other consonants which go silent that drop or change. So so it's really vocalized as Feli and not Peli or something like that, because the word is Pele in Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a, I mean, I'm not too sure if he's answering the question, if this is the writer saying this. I don't know about the question mark, because, you know,
so in other words, what you're saying is that he may be in bewilderment of the question. He may be saying, I can't believe you just asked me that. It's a wonder to me that you just asked that question. Okay, so there's a couple of different ways that you can look at this verse, and what is it saying? Because Yoel, when you really start to analyze this particular verse and you really start to think about it, well, then the next question has to be, well, where else in the Tanakh do we see the name?
There's a big question regarding angels' names. You know, for example, in witchcraft, even in Kabbalah, they do a lot of this thing of, you know, invoking names of angels, and the whole thing is very, very peculiar. But we do have other places where names of angels are mentioned.
That's what I want to know. So that's the next question that you got to ask yourself. Where in the Tanakh do we have the names of angels? What do we have?
So it's really in the book of Daniel. You know, the latter books are the ones that start mentioning names of angels. And I think, I'm going to dare say this, and I hope people don't get really angry with me, but I think that the giving angels names is a direct influence of being in the exile.
Look, it's post-Babylon, right?
It's post-Babylon, and I think that, you know, we say that, you know, these books are divinely inspired, and I think that it's a possibility, and I'm not saying this as 100%, so don't catch me, or please people don't get angry with me for saying this, but I think there's also a point where God uses symbols and ideas that we can recognize.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if God would send something today, it would be something that we recognize. Because, you know, times change. You know, in the beginning, angels appeared as human beings, and then angels appeared as actual, you know, the messengers appeared as actual angels, the ones we recognize today. So it raises a lot of question about, you know, does the Torah, does God really, you know, have a specific culture he wants us to be in, or is it he just wants us to follow the Torah, and the culture can be whatever it is as long as it's not against the Torah? Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of these types of questions I've been dealing with lately. But I remember how come angels suddenly are now beings with wings, and before that they didn't have any wings? Or how come there were no names and now there are names? The Talmud clearly states the names of the angels came with them from Babylon. So I don't know if it's actually the names, maybe the concept of having names, specific names, but also when we break down the names of angels, like, for example, Gabriel. Gabriel is really Gevrael, the man of God.
Mm-hmm.
And Raphael is Raphael, the healer of God. So really, if we take the names of angels, they're named based on a purpose, because they're messengers. They probably don't really have an identity of their own. Their name is based on what they're supposed to be doing.
And Michael, what's Michael's name?
Michael. So Michael can be Mikael, who is like God, so maybe his purpose is to be a praiser of God. It's really the whole world of this whole world of, you know, names of angels. It's very peculiar to me. It's not highly developed in the Bible.
But it is peculiar. But I mean, is there another book besides Daniel that has names of angels in the Tanakh?
Besides Satan.
Well, yeah, but Satan is the adversary, right?
Adversary. I mean, it's not really
a name. And I mean, the reason why I ask is because, as you kind of hinted there, perhaps these ones in Daniel are not names either. They're rather descriptions of particular messages. That's a possibility.
There's just angel. There's no actual name. It's only Daniel. What's also interesting about Daniel is you have a connection there to the Babylonians and the Persians. He is related to them. The Zechariah is really already in the land of Israel and everything. But there's no actual names of angels. There's these angelic beings, we're going to call them, because they're not really messengers anymore. Because we can call them a malach as a messenger when they're coming to a person telling them something. But then we have the point where this, for example, Ezekiel sees the chariot, or Isaiah in chapter 6 sees the throne room, and there's just these angelic beings, what we refer to as angelic beings today. So it's a very, very good question, this whole world of names of angels and how they're used. But the one thing I'm very bothered by is the fact that people invoke names of angels in different ceremonies. Catholics do it. Kabbalists do it sometimes as well. I don't know about the Messianic world. I've never seen any ceremonies or anything, but this whole thing of calling the names of angels, it's very problematic as far as I see it. It does not correspond with the Judaism I grew up with. It doesn't correspond with what I see in the Bible. If you call out to anyone, you call out to the God of Israel.
Amen.
But this thing of knowing names of angels also, there's a lot of witchcraft involved in it. I think there will be a point where we have to speak about the whole issue of witchcraft and what to avoid and everything. But I will say something very simple. I studied Kabbalah under someone several years ago, and I had a lot of question marks. And my question marks grew and grew and grew, to a point where he realized that he basically said, can we please stop? Because there were too many things that did not correspond with what I know as Judaism. And I've been reading Gershom Shalom lately about, for example, his book about Kabbalah and its symbols, understanding Kabbalah and its symbols. And he kind of clarifies a lot of the questions I had. But he still admits that there are elements in Kabbalah that correspond to elements from the mysticism of from the European world, the mysticism of Christianity. And, for example, you take Freemasons, there's a lot of symbols that they took from Kabbalah. But the question is raised, who took from whom? For example, I saw this website that blames Jews for witchcraft. And essentially, I think that, if we look at it correctly, I think that a lot of Kabbalah is derived from witchcraft, and it's the other way around. It says Jewish Kabbalah, Jewish witchcraft, or Jewish Kabbalah, it was very, very useful. I remember there's a writing, there's a Greek writing, if I remember correctly, that mentions that there are Jews who are big warlocks, or whatever you call them. They're very big, very powerful in witchcraft. And I think this part of it happening was Jews who devoted themselves for understanding the manipulation of the spiritual, and they had difficulty realizing that they crossed a boulder. And these were people who were faithful to Torah, faithful to everything, and they just were trying to find the divine experience because of the trauma after the destruction of the temple, first temple and second temple. People, there was prophecy, vastly really dwindling away, and people were trying to
instead of dig deeper in the well for water.
Exactly. That's actually a very, very good example, digging deep in the well of water, because that's one of the symbols in Kabbalah. It's a deep well that you have to pull water out from. And I think it was a response to the trauma. And there was a problem in dividing these things. And I think that we can see that trauma to some degree also in the Bible, where there's certain things that happen. I think the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, for example, show us the trauma of not following the Torah. But I think because prophecies started dying out, people were trying to find other ways, and the border in between what's allowed and what's forbidden was kind of like blurred to a point where people did not see that. Today, for example, you ask an average Yoruba about Kabbalah, people sometimes become squeamish and trying to keep away from it, but they recognize it being part of Judaism. And there were many, many people, if you remember something, there were many, many people throughout the centuries who were against it. Kabbalah was strongly promoted by southern France and northern Spanish Jews who were probably deriving a lot of this information also from Christians. So there's a lot of questions to be asked about this. And we really diverted from the discussion. But yes, there is a question about the issue of names of angels. And there are questions about why to know a name of an angel. And there are, for example, Midrashim that speak about that when the Second Temple was destroyed, the priest who knew had powers and everything. I just don't understand. Priests were just regular people who had regular lives, and they happened to be descendants of the house of Aaron. But they knew the names of the angels, and they're trying to invoke them to battle for them against the Romans, and God changed the names of the angels. Stories.
And to me, that really is a Catholic flavor to it, that kind of thing. And so it is a curious thing. A very curious thing when it comes to the names of angels and how they're mentioned also in Daniel, and certainly something to dwell on and maybe do some study. If anyone has anything to add to that discussion, we would love you to put it in the comments section. So, it says in verse 19, now up to this point, Yoel, the man of God, the messenger of Yehovah, he seems like a guy, right? He's just another guy, but, impressive nonetheless. But here, something interesting happens. And so Manoah took the young goat with a grain offering, and he offered it upon the rock to Yehovah. And he did a wondrous thing while Manoah and his wife looked on. It happened as the flames went up towards heaven.
Says he did a wondrous thing.
That's what
the Hebrew says, "Umafli la'asot to Manoah." Umafli la'asot, it's a question what this means, because umafli la'asot can also be an interpretation of his name, because we said Peli, and now he's called umafli la'asot. So I don't know what to say about this. The whole section here is strange.
Okay, and so rather than saying he did a wondrous thing, it might be saying his name did this while Manoah and his wife looked on. It happened as the flame went up towards heaven, the altar, the angel, the messenger of Yehovah, ascended in the flame of the altar.
And he vanished.
He vanished. He went up.
And that's when the penny drops with Manoah, and he realized this was really an angel.
Yeah, but I know. But this is the thing. He's just given the guy instruction. He's just said, the messenger has said, this is what's going to happen. Now your wife has to do this because you're going to have a son, even though she's barren, but she's going to have a son, and he's going to be like this for the whole of his life, and blah, 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 blah. And but yet, Manoah, what does he say?
He says, we're going to die.
Yeah.
We have seen God. We're going to die.
Forget everything that the messenger just said. That's not going to happen because we're going to die now.
And his wife is being the typical Jew, and she's going, being rational. Okay, think about it for a second. If God wanted us to die, he wouldn't. She's like the only one who actually knows what's going on. She's the only one who has her head in the right place.
That's right.
And she says to him, if God wanted to kill us, he wouldn't take the sacrifice from us, and he wouldn't show us all these things, and he wouldn't have told us all the things he just told us.
That's right.
She's looking at
the next verse just jumps from, duh, the next verse jumps from there to, so the woman bore her son.
I can imagine them standing there, and they bow down, and he's like all terrified, and I can just imagine getting up and looking at her and going, like slapping over the head and going, seriously. I mean, seriously, after everything that just happened here, that's what you have to say. I mean, literally, this is literally. I think to a certain degree that this entire section is someone's trying to be funny a bit. they're just kind of poking fun at Manoah. So I'm being very serious now. I think they're poking fun at Manoah at this.
I think you're right because you read it and you got to have a bit of a giggle. I mean, seriously, he doesn't seem like the brightest spark. But in any case, the woman bore a son and called his name Shimshon. The child grew, and Yehovah blessed him, and the spirit of Yehovah began to move upon him at, where is this?
The encampment of Dan, which is kind of interesting. Why they call it encampment? It's probably also because at that time they were having difficulty where to live. Remember, at the end of the book here, we have the whole thing of the Danites going up to the north as well. They're trying to find somewhere to live. And he's, the camp of Dan, which is in between Tzalah and Eshtaol,
which is
the plain of Judah. So it's an interesting thing.
That concludes chapter 13. And so Shimshon has been born. We better save chapter 14 for next week, I'm pretty sure. Let's see if we can
do chapter 14, 15. If we do 14 and 15, we'll cover the whole story of Samson.
I think we're doing pretty well. My friend...
I'm actually quite surprised that I know that we had one chapter and look where we went. 9 million directions with everything.
It's all relevant.
It's all relevant, yes, but
it's good stuff. Light of the Prophets, boys and girls. Thank you, Yoel Ben Shlomo. His Facebook page is Hebrew in Israel. And if you would like Hebrew lessons from the Levite in the desert, you can inquire by emailing at hebrewinisrael@gmail.com. Thank you, my friend, for coming back onto Truth to You. Truth2letteryou.org. Come back next week because we've got more of Samson. And until then, dear listeners, be blessed, be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.